about Averroes, who is a social and cultural historian of early modern Europe with a particular interest in the history of childhood and animals. He has held teaching research positions at the universities of Oxford, Cambridge and Göttingen, post-Dam and Karlsruhe, and is currently Humboldt Graduate School postdoc fellow at Humboldt University in Berlin. His first monograph, Dam's Boys, Schools and Republic of Letters in Early Modern Germany, portrays early modern schools and intellectual habitats where knowledge was integral to disputes over social rank, and reconstructs in meticulous detail the process through which boys eventually entered the highly exclusive world of the early modern scholar. His second book will be the first modern cultural history to examine the dramatic changes in the relation between Europeans and simians, monkeys and apes, that took place between the 15th and 18th centuries. This project is based on archival case studies in Germany, France and England, court culture, civic culture and pet keeping, anatomy and display. By applying mythologies derived, among others, from material culture studies and the history of emotions, the project examines how human and animal identities were saved when Europeans met face-to-face with non-European animals, so bafflingly similar to them in appearance and behaviour. So.
Yeah, well, thanks for your introduction. Well, thank you for having me, for one. And as you've heard from the description of my current project, I'm really interested in the history of contact between humans and animals. And one of the things that struck me the deeper I got into my project on simians was that a lot of the meetings which were described in the sources I read, the deeper I got into them, the more I noticed that much of the contact also took place with animals which were already dead, that much. And I got more and more interested in the culture of, let's say, prolonging contact to an animal which has died and is now objectified in order to be exchanged, sometimes in order to conserve information, but maybe also conserve serve as an ongoing focus of emotional attachment. And that really led me towards the idea of conservation. And of course, in conservation was a major concern for early modern naturalists and collectors in the sense of the conservation of information about particular specimen that they had. And since it is a question of exchange and interpretation, conservation is at its core also a concerned with media, which serve to preserve and communicate this information. In the mid-1780s, the teenage artist Sarah Stone was commissioned by Ashton Lever, the proprietor of a commercial cabinet of curiosities in London, to draw the most spectacular items in his collection. Sarah Stone included a drawing of two Old World monkeys as part of a collection of watercolours she executed, mostly of ethnographic graphic material. And Stone chose to depict the items on show against a plain background, endowing her representation of taxidermied specimen with highly expressive faces, and thereby producing the illusion of being portraits of live animals. George Shaw, another London artist who specialised in animal portraits, also drew several of the monkeys and apes in Ashton Lever's collection, and similarly depicted the taxidermied specimen as live animals. Now, through taxidermy, rather than graphic artists being exclusively reliant on early depictions of non-European animals or rare animals, or equally unreliable written or oral descriptions as their sources, they now had recourse, or seemingly had recourse, to the animal themselves. Yet impressions were deceptive. While bodies could now be preserved, they could be manipulated to the extent that they reflected more the approach and the skill of the taxidermist than the appearance of the live animal. Artists drew on taxidermied specimen, which, as we shall see, had themselves been sculpted according to models in the visual arts, creating a self-reciprocating cycle of influence. Thanks first to the development of preservation in alcohol in the 1660s, and then the proliferation of taxidermy through the development of arsenic soap in the 1740s, specimens could now be exchanged with unprecedented ease among European collectors and scholars, greatly accelerating the advance of vertebrate taxonomy in the 18th and 19th centuries. So it seemed that the body of an animal could now be examined and re-examined, exhibited and remodeled almost at will. This point had obvious impact on the development of physiology and anatomy, but no less on the history of collections and the visual arts. This revolution of preservation established, in quite a sudden manner, the animal body as a medium of representation in European visual culture. In my presentation today, I would like to explore the relationship between the nascent culture of preserving the animal body and other media on the basis of material sources, in particular, surviving specimen of Ashton Lever's museum I mentioned in the beginning. My paper takes its inspiration in large part from the anthropology of images, which draws a sharp distinction between the image, the picture in which it resides, and the medium which provides the material basis for both. Practitioners of the anthropology of images have been particularly interested in the depiction of the body. But, and this is really the central concern of my paper, what significance did it have for both image and picture if the body resembled or at least alluded to the medium itself? The basic assumption underlying this paper is that this conundrum poses at once inescapable problems of representation and, on the other hand, carries significant symbolic potential for all those who display bodies. In particular, I will be focusing on surviving specimens of early modern simians, that is, monkeys and apes. Simians are particularly suited as animals exemplary of the changes in the culture of collecting and exhibiting animals in early modern Europe, for two reasons. First, they were among the more common non-European vertebrates to reach the continent throughout the early modern period. And second, they were subjected to most technologies and fashions of preservation and exhibition. The second important point is that their similarities both in behavior and physical shape to humans had been exploited in European art and literature since antiquity. And as a result of this, curators wishing to exhibit simians could draw on a rich cache of symbolism and iconographical meaning. A 1784 catalogue of Lever's museum counted 65 glass cases which were said to contain 79 monkeys and apes. Among these were also species which were rare enough to draw interested naturalists into the collection, such as three chimpanzees and a mandrill with two-toned furrows in the face. And this mandrill you saw a depiction of in Sarah Stone's image in the beginning. Though the Leverian Museum was dispersed at auction in the first decade of the 19th century, several simians formerly part of the collection have survived either in the coming museum in Southwark and also in the Museum of Natural History in Vienna. The scenographic apparatus employed for the exhibition of simians in the Leverian Museum illustrates both the strong link that was being forged between the new medium and iconographic traditions in others, as well as the new symbolic possibilities of the animal body as a medium of representation. 18 of the simians on display were set up in what was called the monkey room and were, quote, grotesquely set up. What this meant was that they were displayed in the fashion of the singerie, the iconographical practice of showing simians engaged in typical human activity and attire. This tradition had first been popularized in Flemish genre painting in the 16th century, as you can see here in Peter van der Borst's image, and had gained a new lease of life in the Rococo most famously in the interior decoration of noble residences such as that executed by Huet at Chantilly. And I can't overstress how common Saint-Jolie were in the period. Now there are only, I think, 4 left in France, but a total of 140 are said to have existed in 18th century chateaus. So this was a very popular popular way of decorating interiors. Popular themes were domestic and everyday scenes, and those which showed Simeons engaged in trades and professions, such as scribes or barbers. Equally popular were scenes which showed Simeons engaged in courtship and dressed in fashionable clothes, thereby alluding to the genre of the critique of exaggerated concern for fashionability, but also fads such as the craze for chinoiserie and touquerie. And especially in Chantilly, you can see how chinoiserie and touquerie get mixed up with Saint-Jolie. And you have quite a few Chinese apes dressed in silk. One catalogue of the Livrean collection described the figures as the family gardener, the bellman, the coal carrier, the family tailor, the beau, the ballad singers, and the shoeman. A guidebook to the collection spoke of a second monkey, dressed up like a fop, with a watch chain dangling by his side, a third a porter, with a box on his shoulders, a fourth a watchman, with his mouth wide open as if crying the hour. Another description talked of a room full of monkeys, one of which presents the company with an Italian song. Another is reading a book. Another, the most horrid of all, is put in the attitude of the Venus de Medici and is scarce fit to look at. Of the specimen grotesquely set up, unfortunately, only one survives, with its accoutrements intact, and is now held at the coming museum, where, as well as 3 other specimens of livery and Simeons, have been housed since they were acquired in 1806, and all of which appear to have remained in the fashion in which they were set up in Ashton Lever's museum. Described as a dog-faced monkey in the catalogue through which the Livrean Museum museum's items were dispersed at auction in 1806, this specimen is a particularly fine example of 18th century taxidermy. Set up in the manner of a scribe, hunched, quill in hand, over a desk, as if in intense concentration. And also for this figure, there seems to be a concrete visual source. And I very much think that it's based on this image in Nicolas Gérard's Saint-Jolie Amoureuse, which were very popular in the 18th century, and also circulated quite widely in the British Isles. And if you look closely in the right-hand corner, you can see a monkey squatting, quill in hand, over a letter, a love letter, which I would suspect is the source for the Livrean example. The Saint-Jolie was, however, not the only template on which the specimen at the Livrean Museum were modelled. The postures and accoutrements of several of the surviving specimens were based on images of Simeons in natural histories from the 16th century onwards. The visual traditions of depicting Simeons in early modern scholarly publications were highly clichéd and no less allegorical than traditions of depicting animals in the decorative arts. Messages about animals' position in the highly hierarchical order of nature were coded through the setting, the animal's posture, and items with which the animals were depicted together. In the depiction of Simeons, the central iconographical functions of objects they touched, leaned on, or sat on was to qualify the unnerving ability to stand upright and to walk bipedally. Simeons would therefore almost unfailingly be shown to cower on rocks, lean on branches, or walk with the help of a cane, thereby underlining the point that while certain animals could walk erect, they were nonetheless not in the same league as humans to whom bipedalism came naturally. And here we have another item which from the Cumming Museum, which does the same thing. Edward Tyson's groundbreaking anatomical treatise on an infant chimpanzee in 1699 reinvigorated this visual tradition, since Tyson tried to explain the pronounced curvature of the knuckle-walking animal's hand, equipped the animal with the staff, quote, the better to support him. A clear reference to the visual traditions of works in natural history was the pairing of a number of Liverian specimens of simians with sticks, which they held standing up erect in the manner of a walking cane. And here we have this famous image, which we will refer to in a minute, because one of the specimens which has survived at the Museum of Natural History in Vienna was clearly set up to resemble this image. The chimpanzee was exhibited holding a walking cane, as evidenced by the raised and extended right arm, as well as the fingers curled parallel to the body. Its mode of exhibition made it resemble very closely the one depicted in Tyson's Anatomy of the Pygmy. Also young male, just like the Liverian specimen, with the animal's teeth bared, holding a staff in the right hand with the left hand open, gazing straight ahead at the viewer. Now you'll be thinking, where is the staff? Well, this is really a fascinating development for me, because in Vienna, the chimpanzee underwent a marked transformation at some point during the 19th century to a specimen fit to be displayed in the collection of the Viennese cabinet, which was undergoing a transformation itself from a publicly accessible cabinet of curiosities to a science museum. The Liverian chimpanzee was stripped of its staff, and most importantly for its newfound status in a scientific collection, it received a label, complete with the Linnaean double appellation of genus and species. So now, having been called orangutan mislabeled, or let's say labeled according to 18th century concepts in London, it became a Troglodytes niger in Vienna. In terms of the body of animals as a medium, the fashion of representing the animals the stripping of animals of their accoutrements and presenting them in a neutral fashion as scientific specimen can be seen as an attempt of reducing the distance between medium and image. The technique suggested to the viewer that they were regarding the animal as it was, and not a staging of the animal. The preservation of the animal body fulfilled a dual function in European collections. First, it served the purpose of preserving the outward appearance of the animals in order to render them fit for exchange and examination among scholars. Second, the same specimen were to be the cabinet's prime attractions as showpieces which evoked a sense of aesthetic beauty through the imitation of nature. The gradual development of the Museum of Natural History in Europe as a scientific place of research and exhibition, distinct from the older collections of savants, exerted pressure on the craft of taxidermy, and superficially at least, led to a distinction being drawn between taxidermy for entertainment and for research or education. Yet the issues of preservation and visual practice remained inextricably linked. And at no point was this as clear as during the golden age of 19th century taxidermy, when the preserved animal body was, in fact, ubiquitous in urban entertainment and interior decoration in major cities such as Paris and London. Take, for instance, the work of of Charles Waterton, a very famous taxidermist and conservationist of the period, who became famous for his caricatures of actual people through animal taxidermy. He was a fervent Catholic and therefore felt it necessary to to create a caricature of Luther after the fall, complete with devil horns, and it's probably a chimp that made on the basis of a chimpanzee pelt, though there are people who think that this might be the first taxidermy gorilla to have made it to Europe, though I don't think that that's very likely. But I'm showing you this image because the joke is there because we can see that this caricature was made on the basis of a monkey, of an ape. That's what the joke is. These pieces work precisely because the body was still evident. Since preserved specimen, as the name suggests, needed to at least invoke the appearance of the live animal, they bore iconographical resemblance and as a result also the charge of depictions of the body, be it animal or human, in European visual art. Therefore, in the case of the preserved animal body, the image and the medium could not be separated from each other. Thank you very much.